Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now going to cover Psalms chapter 88. I will entitle this psalm, I Cry Out Day and Night Before You. The heading of the psalm says this, a song, a psalm of the sons of Korah, for the director of music, according to Mahalath Leonoth, a maskil of Heman the Ezrahite. Now, this heading is going to take a little bit of time to go through. Let's start out with the word song, a song. A song is a general term for more particular types of songs, like a psalm is usually a song of praise accompanied by music. A hymn is usually an oral song of praise not accompanied by music. Here, this psalm, as we'll see, is a dirge. I mean, the man who wrote this psalm, Heman the Ezrahite, was one depressed son of a gun. So this is a dirge. Well, a psalm can be a dirge. I've looked at a lot of people who've tried to distinguish songs and hymns and psalms, and I've decided it's impossible because nobody agrees. Well, this is a song, all right, but it's a sad song. It's a song, a psalm of the sons of Korah. Korah was one of the family of the Levites. Korah was actually a grandson of Levi. His family was responsible for carrying the tabernacle, the framework of the tabernacle. Korah was famous for getting swallowed alive by the ground in an earthquake. After Korah had a dispute with Moses and Korah's famous rebellion, that happened mid-15th century B.C., but by the time of David, who ruled from 1010 to 970 B.C., the sons of Korah, the descendants of Korah, were made by David into a choir of Levites. They were appointed to serve in the temple worship. Now, did that choir endure after David's death? Probably, or perhaps. The NIV Study Bible says this psalm perhaps occurred during Sennacherib's time, which was 701 B.C., which was a good bit of time after David, who, as I said, ruled from 1010 to 970. So, Sons of Korah is a little bit indefinite, but it's a choir of some sort, a Levitical choir. Now, more particularly, the heading has the psalm is being written by Heman the Ezrahite. Now, this Heman the Ezrahite, we will see when we look into a verse in Chronicles, he was of the sons of Korah. He was also a descendant of Korah. Now, the song is said to be for the director of music, the choir director, according to Mahalath Leonoth, a transliterated Hebrew word, not translated. The NIV marginal note says that Mahalath Leonoth is possibly a tune called, quote, the suffering of affliction. That's probably reasonable. As we go through this psalm, you'll see one sad, suffering, afflicted Heman the Ezrahite. Jameson Fawcett and Brown says of Mahalath Leonoth, either an instrument as a lute to be used as an accompaniment, Leonoth means for singing, or, as others think, an enigmatic title denoting the subject, that is, sickness or disease for humbling, the idea of spiritual maladies being often represented by disease. The suffering of affliction, that's what the NIV note, marginal note, thinks it means, and that's good enough for me. It's a song. Sounds like a very sad song. Now, still in the title, it says that this psalm is a maskil. Nobody knows what maskil means. The NIV marginal note says, quote, it is, quote, probably a literary or musical term. Now, let's look at Mr. Heman. Mr. Heman the Ezrahite. This is going to take some time, and I'm going to spend more time on this than you should ever spend on a problem. I have just spent all morning trying to straighten out who these two guys are. So I'm going to try to give you the skinny version of it. First of all, Heman the Ezrahite is mentioned in the title of Psalms 88, and I need to mention that his compadre, Ethan the Ezrahite, is mentioned in the heading of the next psalm, Psalms 89. Now, both Heman and Ethan the Ezrahites were David's singers. We know that when we look at 1 Chronicles 6:31. These are the men David put in charge of the music in the Lord's temple after the ark came to rest there. Drop down to verse 33 of 1 Chronicles 6. These are the men who served with their sons, from the Kohathites, Heman the singer, son of Joel, son of Samuel. So here we see Heman is labeled as a Kohathite. Remember, a Kohathite was one of the families of Levi. Kohath was Levi's grandson. So we see Heman was put in charge of the music in verse 31 of 1 Chronicles 6. These are the men David put in charge of the music. The these there, these are the men, refers to a whole list of musicians that are listed in 1 Chronicles 6. We also see that Heman is listed as a Levite appointed to sing by David in 1 Chronicles 15, 16 through 17. Then David told the leaders of the Levites to appoint their relatives as singers and to have them raise their voices with joy accompanied by musical instruments, harps, lyres, and cymbals. So the Levites appointed Heman, son of Joel, from his relatives. And then some other people are appointed. And then lastly, from their relatives, the Merarites, another family of the Levites, Ethan, son of Cusheah. I am assuming that Ethan, son of Cusheah, is the same Ethan, the Ezrahite, all the commentators do. And so we see here the Levites appointed Heman and Ethan, and both of them are Levites. Both Heman and Ethan are Levites. That's important to remember when we get into the weeds here in just a minute. Now let's look at some problems. I've got three. The first problem concerning Heman and Ethan is that 1 Chronicles 2, verses 4 and 6 calls Heman and Ethan Judahites. But as I've just pointed out to you, 1 Chronicles 6 and 1 Chronicles 15 calls those two Levites. Let's read 1 Chronicles 2, verses 4 and 6, starting with verse 4. Judah's daughter-in-law Tamar bore Perez and Zerah to him. Judah had five sons. We drop down to verse 6 to look at one of those sons, Zerah. Zerah's sons, Zimri, Ethan, Heman, Calcol, and Dara. So there we have Judah down to Zerah, down to Ethan and Heman. But Judah is a Judahite. He's not a Levite. So we have a problem here. Well, here's two options to solve the problem. The first option is to simply hold that the Heman and Ethan of 1 Chronicles 2, 4, and verse 6 are different than the Heman and Ethan in the titles of Psalms 88 and 89. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, ISBE, says this, quote, "There were an Ethan and a Heman who were descendants of Zerah, head of a Judahite family," in 1 Chronicles 2, 6. "There were also an Ethan and a Heman who were Levites also." I assume they mean different people. Well, that's the first way you can solve the problem of the different tribes from which these two singers came, the Levites and the Judahites. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown solves the problem by saying the Levites, Heman and Ethan, were adopted into the tribe of Judah. Now that, to me, is a wild speculation. I think it's just as easy or easier to say that the Heman and Ethan that are mentioned in our two separate places in 1 Chronicles 6 and 1 Chronicles 15, where they are called Levites, and in 1 Chronicles 2 and 1 Chronicles 6, where they are called Judahites. They're just different people, different Hemans and different Ethans. Well, that's the first problem. Here's the second problem with Heman and Ethan. Why are Heman in the header of Psalms 88 and Ethan in the header of Psalms 89 both called the Ezrahite in the titles? Well, here's a possible solution. Ezrahite could be from Zerah, which, remember, I just mentioned in 1 Chronicles 2 and 6 that Judah had Zerah and Zerah had Ethan and Heman. Well, that Zerah could be turned into Ezrahite. All you have to do is flip the first two letters by the time you get into English from Hebrew, and I don't know how that works. But let me read ISBE, International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. The word Ezrahite is a patronymic, that means a family name, for Ethan and Heman. It may be derived from Zerah instead of Ezra, seeing that there were an Ethan and a Heman who were descendants of Zerah, head of a Judahite family. That's in 1 Chronicles 2, 6, which I just read. So the header of Psalm 88 and the header of Psalms 89 could have meant to say Heman the Zerahite instead of the Ezrahite and Ethan the Zerahite. But the problem with that is, if you do that, then that makes Heman and Ethan in the headers of Psalms 88 and 89 Judahites, sons of Zerah. And as we've seen, that doesn't work because they're supposed to be Levites. The Jewish Encyclopedia just cuts the knot and says this, the addition of the Ezrahite to the names of Heman and Ethan in the superscriptions to Psalms 88 and 89 is due to an error. Now remember, these headers are not supposed to be inspired. At least most people think they're not. So if we assume there's an error there by calling them Ezrahites in the header, this would leave Heman and Ethan as Levites, separate from the Judahite Zerah, and we don't have any problems anywhere. Now we have a third problem with Brother Heman and Ethan, the Ezrahite. Who are Ethan the Ezrahite and Heman in 1 Kings 4:31, which I shall now read? He, referring to Solomon, was wiser than anyone, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite. Now that's not in a title, that's in the text. Solomon was wiser than anyone, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite and Heman and three other people. Well, how do we handle who this Ethan the Ezrahite and Heman are in 1 Kings 4:31 in Solomon's time? Solomon being David's son. Well, I've got one option to answer that from the Jewish Encyclopedia. Solomon's Ethan the Ezrahite was different than David's singer. This is what the Jewish Encyclopedia says about that. It is not probable that the Ezrahite of Kings, Solomon's Ezrahite, Ethan the Ezrahite, it is not probable that he, who was famed for his wisdom, was the author of a psalm of the tenor of Psalms 89, which moreover must have been written during the exile when the crown of the Davidic family was, as it were, broken. Well, that would mean we have to study Psalm 89, which I'll do in the next two audios, and we will have to make a judgment over whether Ethan the Ezrahite of Solomon's time could have written that psalm. And that to me is somewhat of a hard question. But if we assume that Ethan the Ezrahite in 1 Kings 4:31, Solomon's Ethan, was different than the Ethan the Ezrahite of the header of Psalms 89, then we would also assume that the Heman, who is mentioned in 1 Kings 4:31 in Solomon's time, is different than the Heman of the title in Psalms 88. I don't know. It just seems to me that when you got Ethan the Ezrahite and Heman coupled together right next to each other, it sounds like the same two people. Well, let's leave that swamp and start on our psalm, starting in verses 1 and 2. Heman says this, O Lord, the God of my salvation, I have cried out by day and in the night before you. Let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my cry. Heman just gets started here. He's going to really start crying out as we move on through the psalm. In verse 1, Heman says, O Lord, the God of my salvation. Is he talking about temporal salvation or spiritual salvation? Or both? Well, it's hard to say, but I think he's thinking more temporal here, because these psalmists were always getting into trouble and asking for temporal deliverance. That's just my opinion. That's just my feeling. I can't prove it, but it sure sounds like it to me. They're looking to get out of trouble now in this life. We go to Psalms 88, verses 3. We go down to Psalms 88, verses 3 through 5. Heman continues, For my soul has had enough troubles, and my life has drawn near to Sheol. I am reckoned among those who go down to the pit. I have become like a man without strength, forsaken among the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, and they are cut off from your hand. So Heman says in verse 3, his life is drawn near to Sheol. Sheol, of course, is the Hebrew for grave. It also means the dark, shadowy world of the dead. It can also mean death, grave being a symbol for death. But we will just say it means the grave. Heman was on the verge of death, and he's going to sound like death warmed over as we go through this psalm. He says, My soul has had enough troubles in the first part of verse 3. The NIV Study Bible says, This person was suffering from physical as well as emotional pain. This is one of the saddest psalms in the whole book. I'll say amen to that. Whoever wrote it appears to have been close to death and had been that way for some time. He had also lost his close friends. We'll read about that as we go down through the psalm. Notice the NIV Study Bible says whoever wrote it. They're being very conservative. I'm going to assume Heman wrote it because of the title. In verse 4, Heman says, I am reckoned among those who go down to the pit. In other words, people look at him and they say, this person is about to go down to the grave, because that's what the pit is, the grave. I have become like a man without strength, forsaken among the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more. Now, how should we interpret this phrase, remember no more? Option number 1, Heman is speaking of God remembering the dead in this life, whom you remember no more because you don't need to deal with dead people anymore. They're finished. You protected them in this life, but now that they're dead, there's nothing more you can do for them. Remember that the word remember can mean do something for, like remember me in your will. So it's not just meaning call to mind, but it also means doing something for somebody. So God doesn't do anything more for Haman because he's in the grave. God can't do anything more for him. And this does not mean that God doesn't remember Haman's soul in the afterlife. Well, option number one, Haman is speaking of God remembering the dead in this life, which is now impossible because Haman would be dead. Option number two, Haman is merely reflecting how he feels. I feel that you will remember me no more, but actually in real life, God does remember Haman, whether in this life or the next. This is the NIV Study Bible's opinion that this is not an objective statement that God somehow forgets somebody. Here's the quote from the NIV Study Bible. This psalm is in the Bible to show us that God can handle our words of despair as well as our words of praise. He doesn't expect us to wear rose-colored glasses and go through life pretending it isn't difficult or painful. That's how the psalmist feels. And so, according to this view, and so he's been saying, God, you don't remember me anymore, just like Job did. Remember, where are you, God? So people in the grave, Haman continues at the end of verse 5, they are cut off from your hand. That means they're cut off from your care, as the NIV translates it. The hand mentioned here is the hand of providence, which supplies the living, as Gill says. I think it's easier to say that Haman is being objective. God remembers people that are dead no more as far as their life on this planet is concerned, because that life is over with. They're not there for God to remember anymore. Although it is true that Haman in his grief will say some things probably as we go through the psalm that are not really accurate and objectively true about God. We go now to Psalms 88 verses 6 through 7. Haman continues, You, God, have put me in the lowest pit, in dark places in the depths. Your wrath has rested upon me, and you have afflicted me with all your waves. Well, when Haman says you have put me in the lowest pit, there are two ways you can look at that. Option number one, God actually did put him in the lowest pit to test Haman, knowing that God would rescue Haman later. Or option number two, God didn't put Haman in the lowest pit, but Haman is just expressing his emotions, his anger at God. This is the NIV Study Bible's take on it. I would push back a little bit against that and say, well, you know, God controls everything. So really, yeah, he put Haman in the pit. If Haman was in the pit, God put him in the pit. Maybe not directly. Maybe there were intermediate agents. But behind it all is God's sovereignty and providence. So I don't have any problem with Haman saying that God put him in the pit. Maybe he deserved to be in the pit. Maybe he sinned. It says in verse 7, your wrath has rested upon me. Maybe Haman sinned and God was punishing him. Or maybe he hadn't sinned and he was testing him like Job. Now, of course, if that's true, God's wrath wouldn't be rested upon Haman, because God doesn't put his wrath upon the godly. He might chastise them, but he doesn't destroy them. If that's how you define wrath, that which destroys. Here's another psalmist expressing anguish over what God has done to him. This is David in Psalms 38, verse 2. For your arrows have sunk deep into me, and your hand has pressed down on me. David saying God shooting arrows into him. That's what it can feel like. When you're being tested or when you're being chastised, it's a terrible feeling to feel that God has either disappeared or he's angry with you. So Haman is in the dark, in the depths, in the lowest pit. Also, he's been afflicted by God's waves. Well, that would be like being at the bottom of the ocean covered up with water. It's dark down there too, just like it is dark in a grave. Let's look at another psalm that expresses anguish at how God is treating the psalmist. This is Psalms 42, verse 7, the author of which is the sons of Korah. Deep calls to deep at the sound of your waterfalls. All your breakers and your waves have rolled over me. Now that verse, of course, is used by people erroneously to say this is God's spirit calling to my spirit deep within my heart. That's not what it means. It means that the waves are crashing against each other, and one wave is crying to another wave, with the result that I am swallowed up by the ocean. Matthew 27, verse 46. Citing the words of Jesus, which are a direct quotation of David in Psalms 22, verse 1, first part of the verse. Jesus says on the cross, about the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, which is Aramaic, That is, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, Psalms 22, verses 1, first part of the verse says, my God, why have you forsaken me? So David felt forsaken. Jesus himself felt forsaken. Now notice, however, that many people say that God actually abandoned Jesus in his human person. Of course, he couldn't abandon Jesus in his divine nature, because how can God abandon God? That's a deep theological question, but we can at least say that Jesus felt like God had abandoned him. David felt like God had abandoned him in Psalm 22, verse 1. The whole point of quoting all these verses in the Psalms is to show that many godly people at some time in their life feel that God has abandoned them. The hidden God, Deus absconditus. I think I said in the audio covering Psalms chapter 1 that Deus absconditus, the hidden God, was a theme of the book of Psalms. And here's examples of it right here. Well, let's move now to Psalm 88, verses 8 through 12. Heben continues, you have distanced my friends from me. You have made me repulsive to them. I am shut in and cannot go out. My eyes are worn out from crying. Lord, I cry out to you all day long. I spread out my hands to you. Do you work wonders for the dead? Do departed spirits rise up to praise you? Rhetorical questions, taking no for an answer. Selah, will your faithful love be declared in the grave, your faithfulness in Abaddon? Will your wonders be known in the darkness, or your righteousness in the land of oblivion? So here's some more grief from Heman. Verse 8, he says, you have distanced, you God, have distanced my friends from me. The NIV says, you have taken me from my closest friends. John Gill says that friends often leave one when one goes through adversity, and that, unfortunately, is human nature. But Heman doesn't blame it on his friends. He blames it on God. You have taken my friends from me. When we get to the last verse in Psalms 88, we will see Heman say this, you have removed lover and friend far from me. Or you have removed, better translation, you have removed people I love and my friends far from me. My acquaintances are in darkness. He's by himself. He's by his lonesome. Now David says in Psalms 31:11, because of all my adversaries, I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors. So you see, what other people think about us is important. It's human nature. David says in Psalm 31, continuing in verse 11, and an object of dread to my acquaintances, those who see me in the street flee from me. In verse 9, Heman continues. He says, my eyes are worn out from crying. Lord, I cry out to you all day long. David said the same thing in Psalm 22, 2. Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but I have no rest. Again, God knows what's going on, but this is from the human point of view. We think, where are you, God? I can't stand this anymore. Heman says in verse 10, do you work wonders for the dead? What he means is, if I'm dead, how can you work wonders for me anymore? Now, Heman, as I've said, has been pretty negative, starting here in verse 10. Well, actually, all the way through the psalm, he's very negative. Was he justified in being so negative? Yes, he was, in my humble opinion. The NIV Study Bible points out that, quote, genuine faith forces us to wrestle with God in prayer, especially during difficult times. This is precisely what the psalmist is doing. God wants us to bring our toughest questions to him. Now, I would love to read this psalm to a Copenhagenite, because, my friends, there are negative confessions everywhere. God, you took my friends from me. My eyes are worn out from crying. I cry to you all day. Now, of course, what they would respond was, well, he was sinning. He shouldn't have done that. Whereas normal people, not the hyperfaith heretics, but normal people, would say, no, that is a reasonable human response to tribulation and anguish, and it's just a normal human emotion. There's nothing wrong with doing that. And folks, if you want to find out what probably the number one problem with the faith message is, cruel, the hyperfaith message, it is cruel when you tell somebody who's in anguish, hey, you're sinning because you are crying out from your anguish to God. The hyperfaith people are just like Job's false friends who did that to Job. Job, you're sinning because you are complaining to God. In verse 10, second part of the verse, Heman asked God, do departed spirits rise up to praise you? In other words, people who departed and gone on to Sheol have died. They can't rise up out of the grave to praise you in this life, of course. No. And so he's saying, don't you want somebody to praise you, God? Don't you want to be able to work wonders for me? But I'm dead. I'm gone. Now, that's what Heman was talking about. However, this idea of departed spirits rising up in heaven, not in this life on earth, but in heaven, gives rise to the question of what did the Old Testament saints think about life after death, including the resurrection of the dead? Spiritual life after death and also physical life after the dead, what did they think of it? Now, that is an interesting theological problem, and I'm going to take a little bit of time to go on a rabbit trail here. Because remember, I don't think that this is what Heman is talking about. He's not referring to resurrection of the dead. He's not talking about resurrection of the dead after death in the next life. He's talking about a hypothetical situation where somebody could come out of his grave in this life and it's not going to happen. But let's look at the question, what does the Old Testament say about resurrection of the dead? The Old Testament saints believed in the resurrection of the dead, or at least they believed in spiritual life after death. Now, I'm going to try to briefly show that. And I realize that this is somewhat of a controversial topic, and so these verses are not all slam dunk, but I'm going to show you that the tendency of the scripture is to show that yes, there will be afterlife in the Old Testament, the Old Testament saints believed in life after death. Let's start with Numbers 20, verse 24. Aaron will be gathered to his people. Aaron will be gathered to his people. Well, what does that mean? Even the Hebrew idiom says that if you die, you're going to be gathered to your people. That means that your people must be there after you die. So it sounds like resurrection of the dead. 2 Samuel 12, verse 23. This is when David was moaning and groaning because God punished him for having sex with Bathsheba and they had a child, Bathsheba's baby. And David says, but now he has died, David's son, by Bathsheba. But now he has died. David says, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I will go to him. But he will not return to me. I will go to him. People use that phrase to say that David expected to be resurrected from the dead. But that's not a proof. It's maybe a strong indication, but it's not a proof. He could have meant, I will go to my son in the grave. I will go to him in death, but that baby will never return to life. So that verse is not dispositive. We go to Daniel 12:2. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. That's a classic resurrection of the dead verse, and it's in Daniel 12, Old Testament. Also Daniel 12:13, but as for you, go your way to the end. This is God or an angel, I can't remember which, speaking to Daniel, as for you, go your way to the end, then you will enter into rest and rise again for your allotted portion at the end of the age. That is also not a slam dunk verse. It could just mean he'll get up to get his inheritance, and the end of the age could be the end of the Jewish age, destroyed in AD 70. But it's indicative of, it could be used to support a resurrection of the dead after death in the Old Testament. Job 19, verses 25 through 27. As for me, Job says, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes will see, and not another. From my flesh I shall see God. That also is not a slam dunk verse. Here's an alternate translation of the passage. And after I awake, though this body has been destroyed, then I shall see God. Well, if that translation is employed, Job awakes and he sees God, so that shows life after death, but it doesn't show a physical resurrection, but it still shows life after death. Here's what the NIV marginal note says at this passage in Job 19, verses 25 through 27. Job probably had a general hope of life beyond the grave. It is uncertain, though, whether he thought in terms of a physical resurrection as taught later in the New Testament. Job merely expressed a strong confidence that somehow, somewhere, he would meet God face to face. Okay, so it doesn't prove the resurrection of the dead. Job 19 doesn't, but it does show that Job expected a life after death. Psalms 49:15. This psalm is written by the sons of Korah. But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Ooh, that sounds like somebody's getting redeemed from the grave, redeemed from death. And God will receive him then. Isaiah 25:8. He, God, will swallow up death for all time, and the Lord God will wipe tears away from all faces, and he will remove the reproach of his people from all the earth. He will swallow up death for all time. How does God swallow up death? He gets rid of death. Well, if he gets rid of death, that means the Old Testament saints aren't going to die. Isaiah 26:19, your dead will live, their corpses will rise. You who lie in the dust, awake and shout for joy, for your dew is as the dew of the dawn, and the earth will give birth to the departed spirits. The earth giving birth to departed spirits. That sounds an awful lot like somebody coming out of the grave, a body, a physical resurrection. Their corpses will rise. You who lie in the dust, awake. That sounds like a physical resurrection. That's the best verse right there to show that the Old Testament saints did believe in a physical resurrection. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says, commenting on Numbers 20:24, where Aaron is said to be gathered to his people. The NIV Study Bible says this, quote, "This phrase, gather to his people, in Numbers 20:24, describes the death of a righteous person who died in old age. It also alludes to the Hebrew view of life after death. The Hebrews anticipated reuniting with family members in a mysterious place called Sheol, the place of the dead. David spoke of this reunion when his baby died." I mentioned that, although that's questionable. 1,000 years later, Jesus referred to gathered patriarchs, confirming that ancient believers were indeed still alive. Now let's read what Jesus said in Matthew 22:31-32. "Now concerning the resurrection of the dead, haven't you read what was spoken to you by God? I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living." Now, of course, that's New Testament, but Jesus is quoting from the Old Testament, from Exodus 3:6. God is speaking to Moses at the burning bush. "Then God continued, I am the God of your father, Moses. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." Moses hid his face. So Moses heard God speaking about his ancestors who were dead, been dead for hundreds of years. So Moses would assume that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are still living in the afterlife. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says of Daniel 12:2 and Daniel 12:13. "The Hebrew word for the place of the dead offers few details about what it was like, yet there are hints that the dead would be raised, as I mentioned in these verses I've just quoted to you. Daniel 12:2 is the first obvious mention of the resurrection for both the righteous and the wicked. So the previous references before Daniel 12:2 are ambiguous, as I tried to point out as I went through, even though they're suggestive. But when you get to Daniel 12:2, many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, the others to disgrace, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. So Daniel 12:2 seems pretty clearly to indicate a resurrection from the dead, and these other verses seem to suggest it. And I don't know, the NIV Study Bible says that Daniel 12:2 is the first obvious mention of resurrection, but how about Isaiah 26:19? Isaiah was before Daniel. "Your dead will live, their corpses will rise, you who lie in the dust, awake and shout for joy." I don't know. That sounds pretty much like the resurrection of the dead to me. However, let's get off the rabbit trail now. Remember, the whole purpose of Heman's Psalm in Psalms 88 is to contrast life and death concerning this world. He's dead in this world. He's not talking about the next world. He mentions in verse 11, "Will your faithful love be declared in the grave?" Rhetorical question, answer, no, God can't love me if I'm dead. "Your faithfulness in Abaddon, how can God declare that he's faithful to me if I am in Abaddon?" Abaddon is the Hebrew word for destruction, referring to the grave, of course. That's mentioned in the New Testament, too. I think some demons were coming out of Abaddon. Maybe it's in Revelation. My memory is fuzzy. I didn't look it up. But the idea is destruction. God's not going to help Heman if Heman is destroyed. Verse 12, "Will your wonders be known in the darkness," i.e. in the grave where it's dark? I'm not going to be able to see your wonders anymore, God. "Will I see your righteousness in the land of oblivion?" If I'm oblivious to what's going on, I'm not going to see your wonders anymore. And you don't want that to happen, do you, God? We go now to Psalms 88, verses 13 through 15. "But I," referring to Heman, "but I, O Lord, have cried out to you for help, and in the morning my prayer comes before you. O Lord, why do you reject my soul? Why do you hide your face from me?" Ah, Deus absconditus, the hidden God. "Why do you hide your face from me? I was afflicted and about to die from my youth on. I suffer your terrors. I am overcome." Notice the first thing that Heman does in the morning. He prays. "And in the morning my prayer comes before you." When you're in trouble, that's what you do. You pray all the time. Now in verse 14, Heman asks God, "Why do you reject my soul?" Does God really reject his soul? Well, no, God's not going to reject somebody who loves him. And obviously, Heman loves God. He wouldn't be praying to him in this psalm, even though he's complaining, but he's still trusting in him. Oh, Lord, why do you reject my soul? He felt like he was rejected by God, but he didn't give up on God. He still cried out to God in his pain, as the NIV Study Bible points out. For example, in verse 13, "But I have cried out to you for help, O Lord." So he hadn't given up on God, but he felt rejected. This was his emotion speaking. Now in verse 15, Heman says, "I was afflicted and about to die from my youth on." Now this is interesting. How could Heman be afflicted so badly for so long from his youth? John Gill suggests that Heman was sickly since his youth. Adam Clark suggests that Heman was distressed in his mind and his body since his youth. He was afflicted and about to die from his youth on. I just speculate here. Maybe somebody's persecuting him, coming after him. A lot of evil stuff that happens in life. I don't know, but Heman was feeling bad for a long, long time. He says, "I am overcome. I suffer your terrors." We go now to Psalms 88, verses 16 through 18, and we will finish this psalm. Heman continues, "Your," referring to God, "your burning anger has passed over me. Your terrors have destroyed me. They have surrounded me like water all day long. They have encompassed me altogether. You have removed a lover and friend far from me. My acquaintances are in darkness." Now in verse 16, God's anger is said to be burning. So Heman is subjected to fire, so to speak. God's burning anger. And then he says, "God's terrors have surrounded me like water," which is sort of a switch of metaphors from fire to water. Dying by fire and dying by drowning. Those are two of the most horrible ways to die. And this is what Heman is talking about is happening to him. Surrounded by water, encompass me, he's about to drown. You have removed a lover and friend. That's the NASB translation. The NIV says you have removed loved ones far from me, and that makes more sense to me because the context sure doesn't sound like Heman is worried about a lack of romance at this stage of his life. Heman says, "My acquaintances are in darkness." That darkness could be the grave, so that Heman's acquaintances are actually dead, or it could be his acquaintances are in darkness, and Heman's darkness, he can't see them because he's in the grave, about to be there, with his eyes wasting away. Or there could be another translation. The NIV translates, "Darkness is my closest friend." Adam Clark offers that translation also. But in any way, however you translate it, we can say this. This is a very sad psalm. This is one of the few psalms that doesn't have a hopeful ending to it. It's very strange. I don't think people quote from this psalm too much when they try to encourage the flock. But at any rate, we shall now move on in our next audio to Psalms 89. I'm going to have to split that psalm up into two sections because it's 52 verses long. The first section will be verses 1 through 29, and I will call it "God's Firstborn Will Be the Greatest of Kings." That will be David, who of course is a type of Jesus. And after I finish that, we will go to the end of Psalms 89, verses 30 through 52, which I will entitle "Perplexity About God's Promises." So ladies and gentlemen, I hope you stay tuned for our next psalm, Psalm 89, first part of the chapter, verses 1 through 29, in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this psalm, as sad as it was. See you next time.